From the Sky News Centre at 5. A 57-year-old Palestinian man's been arrested after a British woman was fatally stabbed in Jerusalem. It's understood he had a history of mental health problems. The victim, who is believed to be in her 20s, was attacked on a tram. Paramedic Miriam Levy says it happened in the Old City, an area packed with tourists.
When we arrived, she was in critical condition with knife wounds all over her body. We started CPR on scene and then we evacuated her in critical condition to the Harat Sofim Hospital.
Some flights between Beijing and Pyongyang will be suspended from Monday. Air China hasn't said why they're being stopped, but it comes amid growing tension between the US and North Korea. It's thought the secretive state is planning a nuclear test tomorrow. 98% of teachers say they've come into contact with pupils who've got mental health problems. A union says its research shows children as young as four are suffering panic attacks, anxiety and depression. Dr. Patrick Roach is the Deputy General Secretary of the NASUWT, which is behind the figures. He says there isn't enough support for pupils.
Fewer than a quarter of teachers have any confidence, actually, that access to child and adolescent mental health services will be available when it is needed.
The government says it's spending £1.4 billion on tackling mental health issues among youngsters. Thousands of veterans and supporters have protested in London against what they say is a witch hunt against soldiers who served in Northern Ireland. They say prosecutions and investigations into the actions of troops there amount to hounding. Three children are being treated in hospital on the Isle of Man after they swallowed an unknown substance. Emergency services were called to a leisure centre in Douglas yesterday afternoon. And a man has described how a scorpion fell on his head and stung him on a United Airlines flight. He says he hit the scorpion with a toe, and cabin crew then flushed the remains down the toilet. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Maggs.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Good Friday, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem group leader and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. After the 6 o'clock news, we take a long, hard look at the US threatening China this week because they're the real target of the US Navy carrier strike force now steaming for the Korean Peninsula. As the US empire goes bankrupt both economically and morally, is the only option to kick out with the military against its economic opponents? Plus, in yesterday's dramatic interview, the Syrian President Bashar Assad tells the world he thinks last week's chemical weapons attack on Gan Shehon was a fabrication. He calls it a play. But what evidence does he have for that? We hear the best of that interview yesterday. And the 2004 Beslan school siege in North Ossetia is condemned by the European court. Why did so many hostages die? And is the European right to condemn the Russian military? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. A quick travel hint, the M32 will be shut from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. overnight all next week, pretty much. And on and off, actually most days, until Wednesday the 3rd of May. That's overnight from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry this weekend, and bank holiday Monday, highs of 14 Celsius are mainly cloudy and dry with some sunny spells. Next week, highs around 14 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells this week and mainly dry. Next weekend, the 22nd and 23rd of April, highs around 15 Celsius, creeping up, and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Haven't had a lot of rain for a while, have we? So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem group leader and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. But before that, we'll have a chat to Martin Summers about one or two of this week's stories, particularly this week's chat from Jeremy Corbyn, who's accusing big businesses of killing jobs by refusing to pay their bills on time. The figures here are firms holding back £26 billion at any one time in payments. And what he's saying is that 50,000 businesses each year have been being forced out of... I mean, that sounds unbelievable. 50,000 businesses and £26 billion is not being paid, which is owed to the small businesses by the big businesses.
Well, I think it's their right to highlight this as an issue. I think it's useful that they brought it up. I mean, it's been an issue for years and years and years. I remember Michael Heseltine years ago saying that how he made his money as a property speculator was by not paying his bills on time. And, of course, he was actually the Minister of the Board of Trade at the time, so it was considered to be shocking. But I think anybody who is in business knows that that's how it operates. If you're a big company, you can get away with it. Small companies can't.
Some of the companies implicated here are big businesses. We're talking about Marks and Spencers, the National Grid, E.ON and Capita. Now, look, Marks and Spencers you can avoid. If you don't want to shop at Marks and Spencers, you don't have to. The National Grid, for example, and Capita, you can't, because Capita are doing lots of work for the government, as are, of course, the National Grid, very strongly regulated by the government. So what I suppose I'm saying here is, why is the government itself allowing this sort of practice by its own agencies?
Well, don't forget that Capita is set up essentially to do public sector work, but as a private sector enterprise. And, of course, they're then looking to cut corners to make profits out of things that ought to have been done by the public sector anyway. So basically it's profiteering and using the government as a means to do so. And that's one of the reasons why the British economy is so weak, because we've got too many parasites who are essentially being given the power to make money without actually delivering on what they're supposed to be doing.
Rent seeking
is a very important concept in economics, and it doesn't just mean buy-to-let landlords, although they can be part of it. Britain is a rentier economy. You can make more money by essentially parasiting off other people's work than you can by building a better widget. And that's why, of course, the German and French productivity per hour is far higher than in this country, because for decades we've allowed this kind of profiteering, and everybody's got used to it and thinks it's normal, but of course it isn't.
It's quite within the government's remit to cut off these contracts or fine, surely, National Grid or Capita for doing this. So why don't they?
Well, Capita shouldn't really exist. What Capita?
They do exist. Well, why don't the government act here?
Because the whole point of setting up, what the government have done is they've encouraged private companies like Capita to take over what were previously local authority functions. And of course, once you've done that, then they're going to try and make money by fiddling the books if they possibly can. And the real issue is that they shouldn't really exist. And of course, once they do exist, the government should then regulate them. But if the government regulated them, they would then end up not being profitable, which would then defeat the object of having the private sector involved. So it's all a bit of a circular argument. And we're reaping as we've sowed. I mean, we've been running things like this for years and years and years, and then it's not really a surprise that we're not that efficient.
Gary Hopkins, Knowle councillor, can you just tell us why you think that the government doesn't actually intervene to force people like Capita and the National Grid, who they have contracts with these people, to pay on time? The figures, let me just remind people, it's amazing, the figures. £26 billion at any one time has not been paid to the smaller companies, and there are 50,000 businesses a year going out of work.
It's been my experience. I've seen councils operate and government operate in a very similar manner, that they seem to be actually frightened of the large companies, and they just don't know how to tackle them. With small companies, sometimes they bully them. with larger companies, they stand off. And because the companies take very often a hard line, because they know that if you can keep the money in their bank rather than in the government's, then, you know, they're making cash, it just seems that they take a harder line.
Isn't it simply that big business is just much more powerful nowadays than small business? So actually they look sometimes at small businesses as little minnows that they can, or flies, they can just squash them if they want. And often what they're doing is they're then taking over the job that they used to do.
Well, you've only got to look at the bus services in Bristol, haven't you? And the surrounding area, First Bus, large operator, dominant position. Bristol City Council's been frightened of them for years, and it's only now, with some new powers about to appear for the regional mayor, that hopefully we could do something about them and make them work for the people rather than their shareholders entirely.
So is Bristol City Council more or less frightened of First Bus than national politicians are of people like Murdoch and the national media?
Well, they're understandably frightened of Murdoch because the influence that they actually have is enormous. In some ways, it's the growth of the internet and different means of communication are actually possibly reducing their power a little. But for quite some while, if you got anointed by Murdoch in the on the right wing, then basically you were in.
That's obviously true, and of course he's now trying to, you know, he's back trying to take over Sky, isn't he?
He's not trying. Well, European Court have just said, yeah, fine, go ahead.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's like trying to kill Rasputin, isn't it? He's dragged through the Leveson inquiry and all the rest of it, and then there they are, bold as brass, coming up with the same stuff they came up with before, and nobody seems to be able to stop him.
I'd just like to talk about media for a bit. I mean, I've sort of steered the conversation onto that in a slightly sneaky way, Gary. But what's your take on the local press here? I was just reading through the Bristol Post, I think it was Wednesday this week, and looking at that, and there was an article about Cheltenham Road Library, which had been occupied in a protest by some squatters. And the article opinion piece in the Bristol Post was by the head of the bailiffs company, which was saying, isn't it disgusting that people can act this way? They're threatening our bailiffs officers to going about the right job. I just wonder if the Bristol Post has missed a trick here, because most people reading that will think, well, actually, why is the Bristol Post just giving this, you know, this angle on this story? Of course it's legitimate if there's balance, but there wasn't balance. They also showed not the most of the ordinary squatters, they showed one squatter who had maybe even was a balaclava, you know, to make them look like a terrorist.
Yeah, I think probably the that's one of the worst managed property deals that the city council's ever dealt with. The old baths and library, and then and the library further down on Cheltenham Road, and I think that actually did encourage people to think, well, just a minute, what the heck is going on here? So it was the method by which the council failed to manage it properly over a period of time actually encouraged people to think, look, you know, we need to do something alternative with this property. And yeah, I mean, if the newspaper should be giving both sides of a story, and then possibly having an opinion afterwards, but they should give both sides of the story, and I'm afraid that really doesn't happen with the Post most of the time.
I think this has been going on forever, hasn't it? We've had all this furore about fake news over the last year or so, but frankly, I mean, the tabloid press has been full of fake news as long as throughout my whole lifetime. I remember years ago the Sun turning up in a school where I was working, and then they printed a completely lying story. They said that parents had stormed out of a nativity play because they didn't like the multicultural correctness of it, which simply hadn't happened, but it was reported in the Sun, read by 4 million people, and they wouldn't print any kind of retraction or correction from the school. And of course that's just standard practice, and anybody who's ever dealt with the mainstream tabloid media, and we're not talking about social media here now, knows that they make stuff up, and they've got a, they've got an agenda. They've always had one. They've still got one.
Well, this week we hear that Google has put CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, and the BBC in charge of fact-checking their news. Currently, the growing list of 115 organisations includes the likes of CNN, the Washington Post, NBC, CBS and the New York Times, to name but a few. There's also talk, in fact, this has been in some of the tech magazines, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page, that they're actually, the idea now is that we don't really need journalists and editors. What we'll do is we'll get computers, artificial intelligence, to do the fact-checking on the news stories and to rate them as true or not. So never mind the fact that so many local newspapers are closing down. The National Union of Journalists is doing a campaign on this right at the moment. But I mean, it almost seems as if there's going to be some sort of news bot out there that tells us what's right and wrong, Gary.
Well, at least it wouldn't have an opinion, we hope. But, of course, with anything like that, somebody programs it in the first place, don't they?
Well, that's right. It's called an algorithm, isn't it? And there was a fascinating survey on Google to say just how much their results can be skewed one way or another in an election. So if you're searching for one candidate or another, they can bump up one candidate's profile, in other words, put more good stories about them, and another one down. So this is a bit of a dark art, Martin.
It is, and I'm afraid people have just got to be. I mean, people say that media studies is a Mickey Mouse A level. I suggest that it isn't, because the fundamentals of media studies at A level are to understand how news is produced and to be able to read between the lines. Who is telling me this? Why are they telling me it? I'm afraid business studies is a Mickey Mouse A level, and many Russell Group universities won't accept it as an A level, but media studies, I'm afraid, is a genuine A level.
So what do you make of this
what's required?
What do you make of Google's choice of who's doing these news? Because these are professional journalists,
what we're doing now is, what they're trying to do is make the mainstream corporate-controlled media have a veto over what the alternative media is allowed to say and do. I don't know whether they can make it work, because, frankly, any teenager can go to any site they like, and especially the ones that they're told not to go to are the ones they are going to go to. So, I mean, the banned in Boston problem is going to come up. When you tell somebody that they're not to read something, that's the stuff you want to read. And as you know, on our own page, we've gone through all of the websites which have been accused of fake news, and we've rated them, because, in fact, some of them are actually more reliable than the mainstream. And, of course, the mainstream hates all of this. The mainstream news organisations aren't profitable. The Guardian, for example, is making huge losses because everybody can read it for free. And of course, they hate the whole idea of the modern social media universe where there's no money to be made.
I suppose people would call the Bristolian fake news. Would you, Gary?
It varies. Sometimes they produce some interesting stuff. Sometimes they do make it up, same as other places.
I noticed there was a story this week which is difficult to make up, which was some photographs of Castle Park absolutely covered with rubbish. Park raving mad was the headline. And that, I don't think, is made up at all. It's just looking at the policies now around actually reining back a lot of the cleaning up and the litter collection that the council's doing.
Well, I mean, ironically, I was at the Parks Forum, which is the gathering together of all the parks groups and enthusiasts around the city. They meet every 3 months. A very knowledgeable group of people, a very committed group of people. And basically, they were complaining that for the third time in a row, the assistant mayor was supposed to be in charge of parks.
So who's that?
That's Asher Craig. And basically, for the third time, in a period when she's been in charge of parks, there have been three Parks Forum meetings, and everyone she's promised to turn up, and they're not turned up.
So what's going on when elected councillors, elected councillors who are in charge of our money and the way it's spent in our parks don't bother to turn up or can't turn up, coming up with excuses? Surely, I mean, once maybe, twice, you know, is very unlikely. What's going on there?
Well, it's a disgrace. You can't defend the absolutely ridiculous policies that they've come up with. I mean, parks is a classic example. We're going to make them cost neutral, completely abolish the parks budget within 2 years. I mean, it just cannot be done.
How do you make a park cost neutral? Do you charge people to go in?
Well, that's one thing that potentially they're looking at, but they haven't actually explained it. I mean, you could put so many pop concerts on in some places, and that makes a few pounds, you know, but eventually it is going to cost money to run parks, and they're absolutely vital for the physical and mental health of the people in Bristol. And yet, the person who's, you know, come up with this crackpot plan doesn't even bother to turn up. Unfortunately, council officers who are responsible for trying to deliver this lunatic idea, they're being used as human shields, so they turn up.
Gary, a few years ago, you were being accused of trying to actually sell off parts of our parks.
Yes, something untrue, fake news. Basically, what we were proposing to do was to get rid of some of the peripheral pieces of green space which weren't used so much, and invest all the money back into the parks, because there was a shortage of funds. That's become even more desperate now. Not only is there no capital, they're planning there's going to be no revenue to run the parks.
So
and incidentally, that policy was put into practical practice in my ward, where we agreed to sell off a third of a disused playing field for social housing, got a lot of money in, great long list of plans in the local parks to spend the money on. I'm afraid the mayor's confiscated the money. And so all the plans for the improvements in the parks have had to be ripped up. Disgraceful.
So what are they planning to do? Put sheep, farmers' sheep in our parks to help pay for them?
Well, I don't know. They tried that with the clearances, didn't they, some years ago, and that didn't go desperately well. The point is, they don't have a plan. And having then sent officers down some months ago to say to all the Parks Forum, the experts, how about, coming up with some ideas, so they're being nice people, they come up with some ideas that might help to raise a few pounds coming in, and then the assistant mayor doesn't even bother to turn up to listen to them.
Well, I mean, we don't usually do international stories on here, but Canada today has unveiled plans, the BBC tell us, to legalise recreational marijuana, Martin.
Well, the only other place that's done that is Uruguay, I believe.
Holland.
In Holland, marijuana remains illegal. If you go to Amsterdam and talk to the police, as I've done, it's still illegal. But they choose not to enforce the law, but they can if they if they don't like you.
Okay, what do you make of this decision?
In fact, I had some confiscated from me by a police officer in Amsterdam who explained the regulations to me.
And what did he do with it then?
Well, that's a good question. I started asking. I did ask. I said to him, "Well, you've got all these shops where you can buy it. Where do they get it from? Am I asking too many questions?" And he said, "Yes, you are." And that was the end of it. He bought me a drink. He confiscated.
But anyway, on the wider issue, legalising marijuana makes sense or not?
Well, I mean, it's baby steps in the sensible direction. The real problem is the massive money laundering that's going on in the banking system for all the drugs.
Okay, but I mean, surely our teenagers, some of them are getting schizophrenia, all sorts of mental
illness. Nobody suggests that this stuff is good for you any more than smoking fags or drinking beer is good for you. But you've got to have an adult attitude to it. I mean, it shouldn't be available to those under a certain age, and those who are over a certain age should be warned of the dangers, and it shouldn't be advertised and all the rest of it, just like booze and fags.
It's a health issue. It's not worked very well in terms of making it a crime issue. But basically, better control could be delivered with sensible management. I'm afraid that at the moment there's a huge, huge job that the police are trying to do out there with not enough resources.
Well, it's an undoable job in any case, isn't it?
Yeah.
As the police will tell you.
Yeah.
The prohibition of alcohol didn't work too well in the United States, did it, between the wars?
Depends if you're in the mafia or not. They've got a different view of it.
Mm. Well, this is the problem, is the illegality of the international drugs market is creating a huge... I mean, in 2000...
It's now included in our GDP, isn't
it? Well, yes, I know.
How do they know how much
money...
Well,
they just make a guess, don't they? I mean, but in 2009, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime produced a report, mostly written by police officers, which pointed out that the banking system had been saved by the drug cartels. And that's how embedded the international drugs industry is. HSBC were convicted of working with the Mexican drug cartels, and then they get a fine, which is far less than the money they've made from working with the cartels. And Lord Green, obviously Sir Philip Green, ends up working as a government minister, far from being punished. Meanwhile, teenagers can have their careers ruined by being arrested on a street search.
Also, we're here this week that we've got various strikes looming, some definite, some just being balloted. Nurses considering taking strike action over their low pay, not being able to afford to live. Strike threat also after Royal Mail just simply, without consulting, closed their pension scheme. And Virgin Trains East Coast staff are staging a 48-hour strike. Now, guess what? That's over. That's over conductorless trains. We're looking at some sort of... I mean, I don't know. These always seem to be reported separately, these little looming strikes. It does seem like there's a bit of a... You know, maybe the unions over the spring and summer are starting to think, well, look, we just had enough of this, Gary.
Well, see, I mean, there was 5 years under the coalition government where there was a squeeze. Now, when the coalition government started... Country's finances were in a mess. People weren't happy about the squeeze that was happening on wages, freezes, etc. But they were prepared because they saw there was a pretty wide-ranging effort to tackle the financial problem. They sort of swallowed and said, yeah, okay then. Now they see it's a completely different complexion. What they can actually see is that some people are getting away with it in spades, and others are being squeezed disproportionately, and really there's a different motivation behind the government. The government does not represent the majority of people any longer, which it did for a while, and I think that's why the unions are saying we've had enough, and their members are actually pushing them hard.
I think it is member driven rather than driven by the officials. And, you know, we've had a pay freeze in the public sector for several years now, which means with cost of living rising that people's, you know, living standards are being squeezed. But it's also to do with things like driverless trains and so on. This is a pretty fundamental change in the way the railways work. And if you think about it, having no person to talk to at all on a train...
Hang on, let's just get this right. It's not a driverless train, it's a conductorless train.
Sorry, conductorless train, yes, I've got...
Driverless train.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, we could move towards having everything automated, but the fact is, what happens if something goes wrong? I'm afraid there are little tow rags out there who push things onto railway lines. They shouldn't do it, but they do. And I'm afraid, you know, with no conductors and so on, you can't deal with those emergencies. What if somebody has a heart attack? What if there's a robbery? There's all sorts of things that can happen, and you need somebody there to deal with it. And just getting rid of them is not a solution.
Also, we hear this week... I mean, just adding to those various strike threats there, the Bristol Post this week, 800 GPs in the southwest could be set to leave the profession as morale hits an all-time low. So it's not just the nurses and the rest of those people we were talking about just then. It's obviously quite a lot of people in the important public professions that are just getting fed up. I mean, the 90% apparently of patient contact that these people manage that have done this report, but they get only 7 pence in every pound of NHS resources. Let's just look at this story a little bit more here. Bristol's 48 GP surgeries could be swept up in a southwest NHS staffing crisis over the next 5 years after 800 doctors signalled their intention to leave. Exeter University survey of 2,000 GPs in the southwest revealed more than a third plan to leave their jobs in the next half decade. The researchers say the 1,080 who reported low morale were likely to quit. Now, I imagine that means going abroad, that sort of thing, or else just taking early retirement of some sort. Exeter Medical School professor and practicing GP John Campbell led the study. He said the results of their research added to an ongoing NHS crisis in England. He said the GPs are simply not being enough given enough resources to do their work. They manage 90% of patient contacts with the NHS, but attract just 7 pence in every pound of NHS resources. It's unsustainable, Gary.
Yes, and basically the NHS has had a problem right from when it was first started, in that the consultants and the high-tech end have always taken a disproportionate amount of the money, and it's got steadily worse. So, you know, I think at some point we have to reevaluate and say, do we want to spend the money on in the areas which affect the majority of people, basic health care, or do we want to give it to, you know, ever higher salaries for specialist consultants with ever higher technical abilities? And it's a problem.
Dr. Lucy Pocock, she's a senior clinical research fellow at the University of Bristol School of Social and Community Medicine, said many Bristol GPs' current responsibilities, Martin, can see them work a week's worth of full-time hours in just 3 days.
Well, yes, it's, I mean, we had the GP strike, if you remember, not long ago. And
junior doctors,
yeah. I mean, when people say that they're not happy and they go on strike, that's because they're not happy. And I think another big cost for the NHS is drugs, because the pharmaceutical companies insist on getting massive payments, far more than the drugs are actually worth, because they've got monopoly power through the patent system. There's a very strong case for nationalising all of that and running it at cost.
Well, Chancellor Philip Hammond has been here in Bristol, and he wants the region to embrace the new Metro Mayor and the West of England Authority with an open mind, but he's upset Labour MP Kerry McCarthy by saying, no, there's definitely not going to be electrification of the railways coming down here, Gary.
Well, I'm afraid it's just a pledge from the government that's been broken. We need the electrification, not just on the main line, but across the whole area, and I'm afraid that you know, it's been a badly managed rollout, and they've run out of money and now trying to justify the cut by saying we're getting something else instead. Well, sorry, but the government failed.
So it looks like Cardiff are going to get their electrification, but Bristol and the rest of the South West, Taunton down to Exeter, etc., is not.
Not acceptable. We actually, in this sub-region, generate a huge amount of money which pays the salaries of the Chancellor of the Exchequer and large amounts of government spending. We make a profit in this sub-region. We need to be looked after.
I think many people just look at what's being spent down here in this region and say, well, it's just simply not enough. I mean, it might be stretching a point, but this is one of the reasons why people were so upset that they went to the Maidan Square in Ukraine, because they realised that all their taxes pretty much were being paid into the central government in Kiev, and yet hardly anything was being spent in the Ukrainian regions. This is getting worse and worse, isn't it?
Well, I think the Ukrainian case is a bit different. There's a lot to be said about that, but it's not quite the same.
Well, that was one of the reasons that
people
were saying,
reasons,
yeah.
But there was all sorts of other things going on there as well. I think there's no case, as Gary's pointed out, we're now cutting inheritance tax for the wealthiest people in the country. There can't be any case for doing that while you're still cutting things like electrification, NHS spending and so on and so forth. But of course the Tories, who are no longer in coalition, can now do what they always wanted to do, which is basically give handouts to their friends and kick in the teeth for everybody else. And everybody can see that there's no real practical basis for this. This is just ideological. And of course I think Tories, the account of the coalition is slightly dubious, because of course they tried to cut too fast and had to stop, because of course you can't cut too if you carry on cutting you actually just cause the economy to crash, and they were going too far too fast, and then they had to back off. But in actual fact, the timescale for reducing the deficit is pretty much what Ed Ball said at the beginning of the whole process, and we're still on target for that. But at the same time, we shouldn't be cutting taxes on the wealthy. just totally unjustified.
Gary, without plugging your Metro Mayor candidate too much, because we've got a proper hustings coming up in 2 weeks' time.
Yep.
I think everybody but the Conservatives have confirmed that they'll be along to that. What do you make of that? Is there actually any point in having this Metro Mayor and this Metro Mayor election? Is it going to be a good, useful thing?
Well, the combined authority and the powers that are with it are very, very useful. Not before time, and there should be greater powers brought down. Having the power across the west of England, although North Somerset have opted out, to actually have a proper integrated transport system that's run for public benefit is a very important power. Whether you, in the first place, I don't believe that having an elected mayor to do it was probably the right thing, but if you're going to have that, you've got to have the right person who's got some experience and has got some idea as to how to do it.
But Bristol City Council used to have that power.
No, it didn't.
I mean, surely back... OK, we're going back a while, but 1950s, 1960s?
Well, basically, we haven't had the power to run public transport for a considerable period of time.
Are we talking about Thatcher, I would imagine, and the privatisation of the buses, this kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly that, and the failure of successive governments to do anything about it, despite the fact that local authorities of all colours have told them for a very long time, give us the power and we'll improve things quite dramatically. And that doesn't mean the authorities actually running the bus services. It means them regulating them so that they run for public benefit. So you don't have the ludicrous position that we've had in Bristol for quite some years, where first bus make enormous profits running down the main routes, and then as soon as they lose a couple of pound on a secondary route, they got the begging bowl out wanting some subsidy. And that has to change. We have to move to a franchise system, and that is an essential thing, and that is the big difference between the two candidates who can win this election.
Is it all worth it, this Metro bus nightmare? I mean, I was just saying right at the start of the show, we've got from next week all the way through to, I think it was Wednesday, the 3rd of May, or the 4th of May, overnight closures on the M32. We've had loads of delays on there in the city centre, various other parts of the city. People have been just banging their heads on the dashboard saying, come on. And I think people are also wondering, is this Metro bus really going to be the silver bullet that we're hoping it is?
Well, I think people who are involved in delivering it, and I was one of those for some while, never claimed that it was going to sort all the problems. What we are saying is it will make a positive contribution when it's built. And if George Ferguson hadn't got involved, it would have actually been working over 2 years ago, which is when it was originally planned to open.
Explain that. Why is that? Explain that.
Well, because he actually wanted to change the route in the city centre in Bristol, had a fallout with North Somerset Council on that, had to go back to government to get it all rejigged and re-agreed, and that actually slowed the process down by over 2 years and increased the cost quite significantly, by the way. It would have been open by now 2 years ago if it hadn't been for Mayor Ferguson. Having said that, the scheme will actually produce some improvements, but it won't solve everything by itself.
Do you know how many there's going to be an hour? Because it seems to be going down all the time. I think last I heard it was 3 an hour. It started at 5, then 4, then 3. Is it going to go down to 1?
Well, it shouldn't go down any further than that, because the key thing about a system like this, it's got to be frequent enough that people can turn up and know it's going to be there. The technology's got to be...
kind of on spec, so they're not saying it's going to be at this time. They're just saying, well, let's turn up.
No, it's not going to be that.
There'll be one within the next 10 minutes.
And the technology will be there to... because it's an integrated system, will be there so that people will know when the next one's coming along, like a tube train. And that's why the tube system works so well. People,
and the buses definitely have improved with that, with those little signs on the bus stops. Many of the bus stops have got that's helped a lot.
It has helped, but that system doesn't run perfectly. It will run better with the integrated metro bus system.
Martin, what do you make of this Metro bus? Have you been stuck in any of the delays?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I don't know enough about the detail. I think the thing is, once you've committed yourself to doing something like this, and we're at this stage of the process, there's nothing we can do now except finish it off and see if it works.
Gary, when is it going to be finished? When is it all going to be open? And we can say, well, there's no more delays.
I wouldn't make any promise on that at all.
I guess?
Well, next year. But, I mean, it should have been open in 2015.
Well, Mark Bradshaw was saying this year.
Well,
he was saying September, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm afraid there's a somebody.
Is there a sweepstake on this?
Who's managed to fall out, managed to be in two cabinets and managed to fall out with both the mayors. Quite an amazing record, really.
Which mayors?
Well, Councillor Bradshaw was working for Mayor Ferguson and got sacked, and then he's just left the present cabinet, hasn't he?
Oh, right. So, interesting. With his own party.
After when his own party actually put out some rather nasty publicity saying that he was going to be sacked, speculating, put that poison in the post a few days before it was officially announced.
Amazing. Well, also, I mean, to be fair to Mark, I mean, and to George, I think he was sacked because he was standing against George. He announced his candidature to stand against George, so that was the reason or excuse that was given.
Well, I think the real reason was that after a year of not realising what was going on, he realised eventually that the sale of the Bristol port was a disaster for this city, and eventually started speaking out about it and wanted to make some inquiries which were very relevant to transport. And I think that's why George Ferguson got rid of him.
Well, it wasn't a disaster for the Bristol Port Company, was it?
Well, no. They did rather nicely out of it, thank you very much.
And
we'll be doing even more nicely in the future.
The merchant venturers that run it?
Well, I'm not interested in which clubs they belong to. All I know is that that freehold that the city held was worth massively more than was paid for it, and strategically it's left the city massively worse off.
So why did it happen, and why at the price?
Well, I didn't agree with it, and a lot of councillors, once they realised what was going on, didn't agree with it. It happened because we had a mayor system who didn't have to consult with anybody else; he could just do it.
So are you just against the mayor? Do you think it was better when we had the parties and a party leader running the council?
Absolutely. They had to consult with others in their own party, and they had to consult with others in other parties quite a lot of the time as well. So you got a consensus of opinion, things that actually worked. I mean, we've now had two mayors who haven't got a clue what was actually involved with the job in the first place. The first one got voted out after a short time, when he stood for re-election, got thrown out. The second one hasn't even lasted through his first year before things have started to fall to bits. It's not a sensible system.
I mean, from what you were saying about the Asha Craig earlier not going along to an important forum, which is part of her responsibility, is it a sort of ivory tower mentality that's developing?
Yes.
Explain. How do you see that playing out in the council?
Well, in the previous system, people got elected by the wards, people saw what was actually going on, and they came together as a team. I was part of the cabinet some years ago. You had your own areas that you were actually responsible for. If they were going wrong, then your colleagues got upset about it. If there was big decisions that affected big, large areas, then basically worked very much as a team to put it together. Now you have a mayor who has practically unlimited powers, and he appoints people. And basically the mayor can't know what's going on in lots of areas, and actually more decisions are actually being taken by unelected officials rather than the politicians. And the politicians just don't seem to take the same responsibility that they did previously.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I voted against having a mayoral system. And I'm not really that keen on having a metro mayor either. As you said, you could have something at that level, but it doesn't have to be a mayor. It could have been some other system set up.
Well, I mean, you could have, obviously, I mean, one of those things, you could have councillors from the various authorities appointed to it. But it does make sense to have an elected chair of that, and that's effectively what that metro mayor is.
Well, I think with the turnout that's likely to be, I think that they haven't got a sufficient mandate. And of course, the previous system meant that they had to talk with other people, you got to build consensus.
So, Gary, if we had a vote, which we did, to have a mayor or not, why didn't we have a vote to see whether we wanted a metro mayor or not?
Because the government decided we shouldn't be consulted. And fortunately, in Bristol, we now have won the right, after a battle, to reverse the position that's and say that we don't want a mayor in Bristol and that we will have that
right. That's Lady Jank, the former council leader, Barbara Jank's work, I think, isn't it?
Well, it was between the two of us, actually. I set up the petition, got lots of support for that, and then the other parties fell into line and said, OK, we won't oppose you. So I worked with Barbara, and she got an amendment to the appropriate bill in Parliament, and between us we persuaded the Tory minister not to reverse it in the Commons. So now Bristol has the same rights as every other authority from the past that had a mayor to say, I'm sorry, we don't think this has worked, we want to go back to the previous system.
So when's that referendum likely? Is it likely?
Well, the period was 10 years, so basically, you know, we've got another 4 or 5 years of this system to go. I know. But I think there is some logic in that as well, because, let's face it, a lot of people would have voted against the mayor system, having seen Mayor Ferguson. We didn't know then if the new mayor would make a significant difference and if all of a sudden people thought it was a good idea. I think once we've seen two mayors of completely different types, and people say it's the system rather than the individual.
Also, the Bank of England this week has been implicated in the LIBOR rigging scandal by secret recordings taken in 2007 and 2008, interestingly. Only just now come to light, 10 years later. The BBC has reported that, according to the BBC, the 2008 recording adds to evidence that the central bank repeatedly pressurised commercial banks to push their LIBOR rates down during the financial crisis, effectively twisting their arm to get them to commit fraud, Gary.
Well, it was fraud afterwards, after the regulations were in place, when central government was doing it, when this dates back to. I don't think the legislation was the same. But is there any surprise?
Yeah, it's shocking, because what this means really is things like the interest rate and the oil price are fundamental to prices in the rest of the economy. Absolutely, every other price in the economy is determined one way or another by those two prices. And if those two prices are rigged, then we haven't got a free market. Now, I'm not a free marketeer. I don't believe in the free market, but apparently the government does. But we haven't had one. It's all rigged.
Apparently what the Bank of England were trying to persuade and succeeding in persuading Barclays to do was something called lowballing, Martin. What is that?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I believe what they do is that they have to, the various people who set the LIBOR rate, they have to say what they think the rate is that day.
Okay, so I'm guessing lowballing is saying it's lower.
Yeah, so in other
words, it's a certain rate, and they will then say, oh, take it down a few pegs,
you can see why the central governments would want to keep interest rates low, because otherwise the banking system would have collapsed, and everybody would have been, not many people would have been very happy with that. But the point is that you've got huge moral hazard built into the system now. Any uptick in interest rates is likely to cause a collapse of the system.
And of course, whatever happens to the economy is not actually a true result of what the government's up to. Anyway, look, there was a really good panorama. It's not often I say that on this programme. There's a really good panorama this week on Monday evening called The Big Bank Fix, featuring some of the people who featured on this programme, which is Tom Hayes and his girlfriend, the guy who was called Rain Man when he worked for UBS and various other banks, and he was the guy that was jailed for 10 years. Here, Mervyn King starts this clip from that programme, and he's talking a little bit about what was going on in 2008.
Banks were so unwilling to lend to each other that LIBOR became...
But when Mervyn King, the then governor of the Bank of England, was called to answer questions before Parliament in 2012, he said there was no instruction to doctor the LIBOR rate.
Well, of course, this is like the temperature. When a patient is sick, you want to bring the temperature of the patient down. But there's a world of difference between trying to think of what measures you could adopt to bring the temperature of the patient down and actually tampering with a thermometer. That was nowhere near anyone's thoughts at the time.
But so tampering with that thermometer, LIBOR, is exactly what the Bank of England had ordered.
We were not aware that
Mervyn King's second-in-command at the Bank of England was Paul Tucker. Despite making that call to Barclays boss Bob Diamond back in 2008, he told MPs he'd only just found out about lowballing.
In your recollection, when was the first time that LIBOR was raised as an issue in relation to lowballing?
I mean, I wasn't aware of allegations of lowballing until the last few weeks.
Ditto Bob Diamond.
The third time, what month did you discover the lowballing was going on? Just give me a date.
This month.
It sounds to me like those people giving evidence, particularly Bob Diamond and Paul Tucker, were misleading Parliament. That is a contempt of Parliament. It's a very serious matter, and I think we need to urgently summon those individuals back before Parliament to explain why it is they appear to have misled MPs. It's extremely serious.
Bob Diamond told Panorama, "I never misled Parliament, and I stand by everything I have said previously." Mervyn King says that his evidence was clear and he stands by it, and that there is a world of difference between dysfunctional markets and criminal behaviour. Paul Tucker didn't respond to our questions. But Panorama has discovered evidence that the Bank of England was involved in LIBOR rigging even earlier. We found a confidential US Department of Justice document that shows Paul Tucker began pressuring Barclays to lower its LIBOR rates from the 1st of September 2007.
So you've now got two separate bits of evidence, one dating from October 2008, one dating from September 2007, over a year before, where there's clear evidence, audio evidence and written evidence, that the Bank of England were pressuring Barclays to lower LIBOR. It suggests that it was part of a more systematic and ongoing attempt by the Bank of England to put pressure on Barclays.
But the trials of the Barclays bankers didn't get to hear this and much of the other evidence of lowballing because the Serious Fraud Office said their LIBOR conspiracy had come to an end on the 1st of September 2007.
Amazing. A year before the financial crisis, and just when they discovered that this was going on. I mean, I suppose actually the sting in the tail here with this documentary and that little clip there, Gary, is that they're saying, well, the Serious Fraud Office just gave up on the investigation, even though they had evidence.
Well, I mean, it's not good. But having said that, you can only rig a market for so long, which is what the government and some of the banks were doing. And eventually, the pressure of money from people who know how to make money and take a different view will force the fix out of the system.
7 years or so, it looks like they were doing this for. I mean, officially, it's probably only four or something, but it looks like a long time that this has been going on anyway. I suppose at the end of the day, when people, you know, they just lose trust, Martin, in the money markets and also lose trust in the Serious Fraud Office to actually do their job.
Well, that's right. I mean, when the savings and loans scandal happened in the 1980s, up to 1,000 people were sent to prison in the United States of America for various, you know, misdemeanors. But only Bernie Madoff this time around. And I think that to pick up on what Gary was saying, I think the markets are still rigged. And everything is still being rigged. I mean, you can't have a quantitative easing and zero interest rates for 8 years. That's not in anybody's textbook. And, of course, what will happen at some point is interest rates will be forced up by some means or other. And then, of course, everything will collapse just in one go. They've got to have virtually zero interest rates to keep the whole show on the road.
I mean, in this secret recording that was aired on this programme and has been, you know, aired quite well over the last week or so, on one end of the phone was one of the Barclays LIBOR managers, and on the other end of the phone was their Japan chief of Barclays, a guy called Mark Dearlove. Now, he's the nephew of someone called Sir Richard Dearlove, who was a former Director General of MI6 and is also an attendee of the Bilderberg conferences, etc.
Well, I mean, these people are all well connected with each other, aren't they? These, you know, the technocratic elite that runs things.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they, I mean, there's a very strong connection between MI6 and Hambro's bank in the City of London, for example. So ex-MI6 officers end up working for Hambro's. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International was very much a creature of the CIA. The Newland Hand Bank in Australia are the same. You know, the intelligence services, because of their involvement in the drugs industry and so on, they are very much involved in moving money around. And people, you know, there's a revolving door between them and the banking fraternity.
Okay, coming down to earth a little bit. 928 carers in England quit every day as the social care system starts to collapse. This is a report in The Guardian, Gary. What is being done in Bristol to try and make sure it doesn't collapse? Because there's so many people, elderly people particularly, that we love, that we want to make sure that they are looked after and that they're not just either abandoned or they're kept staying in a hospital and unable to return home.
Well, I'm afraid this will be another consequence of Brexit, that position, which is very difficult, is going to get an awful lot worse, because we're already seeing that people who kept care system and other industries functioning in this country have decided that they're being told they're not welcome and are returning to the continent, and that's one of the reasons why we're desperately short of staff in a number of vital industries.
Is it nothing to do with the fact that the pay is so low?
Well, clearly, you know, if you pay somebody a lot more money, you'll have much more chance of getting people in.
What about the days when the city council used to manage this directly? I mean, surely that's much better rather than... I mean, if a company's just there to make profit, it's not going to be dealing with the elderly in the same sort of way as a company that's there to provide a public service, surely?
It depends on the company. Certainly, the city council, when it came out of out of the care system and moved into commissioning, its costs went down. Having said that, most of the private sector operators are actually rather good. Some of them are not.
I think fundamentally, when it was run by the council, I think they were paid something like £9 an hour. And of course, it was cheaper to run it by the private sector because they just paid less. I think as a society, we've got to say that this work is vital, and we're going to pay people to do it, and we're going to pay them reasonable wages, and we're going to give them job security. That's what we ought to commit to as a society, and if that means we have to get rid of nuclear weapons, well, so be it.
Final story this hour, cell phones, Wi-Fi and cancer. Well, smartphones, etc. Will Trump's budget cuts zap vital electrosmog research? Well, this is really a US story, but it affects us all, doesn't it? What do you, just in a nutshell, both of you, Gary, you first, do you think that we're aware enough of the effects of these phones on our health?
I don't know. I don't have the technical qualifications. I'm wary, but I don't think there's proof yet as to how dangerous they actually could be.
I don't know either, but I certainly do know that radar, for example, was shown to be extremely detrimental to those who were working it in World War II and afterwards. But of course, they wanted it so badly that they weren't prepared to allow that to come out.
OK, now time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to our guest, Lib Dem group leader and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. After the Murdoch News, we take a long, hard look at the US threatening China this week, because they're the real target of the US Navy carrier strike force, which is now steaming for the Korean Peninsula as the US empire goes bankrupt economically and morally. Is the only option to kick out militarily against its economic opponents. Plus, in yesterday's dramatic interview, Syrian President Bashar Assad tells the world he thinks last week's chemical weapons attack on Gan Shahan was a play.
On your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.